back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous film called Beyond the Spectrum, The Unwounded Sasquatch. Darcy Weir's in the house. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Simon? Yeah, it's The Unwounded. Unwounded.
Told you I'd screw it up.
It's all good.
I guess we should start right at the beginning. Why Bigfoot and why not, I don't know, ET or UFOs or something like that?
Well, actually, I've made a few documentaries already on ET and UFOs. Oh. This documentary is part of a series of documentaries that I've made, all starting with the name Beyond the Spectrum. And I think the Sasquatch is an interesting cryptid to study. You know, there's a lot of people out there that say they've seen Loch Ness or some sea monster, or in Mexico they have a cryptid called, it's escaping me here, the Chupacabra. And in the UK, there's, in the moors and the areas of northern England, around Scotland even, they said that they saw this giant being called the Gray Man in the hills of their lands. And then there's the Sasquatch, which is also known as Bigfoot. Sasquatch is the name given by the basically the Native Canadian tribes of Canada. And Bigfoot was the name that was coined for this cryptid in the United States in the 1950s. I originally was not actually attracted to this subject at all. I thought it was just another crazy thing that people could believe in. You said, why have I not done stuff on UFOs and ETs? I have. But that was my first love and interest in terms of documentary making. And then when I came across Bigfoot, I kind of fell in love again. And I think it's an interesting subject that actually deems some serious investigation from people.
Oh, I'm not in denial, man. If you were a skeptic watching, before you watch this film, I don't think you could be when you finish watching this film. I mean, I think you really dug deep into it. I think your archival footage was lovely, which I want to get into. And I mean, I'm still undecided now after watching that. That's my first statement. Now, you start off the film with actual news footage. How did you find to stumble upon that?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, in parts of Canada, there's still lots of sightings that happen every year. And CTV, which is a Canadian television network, they've done a few stories each year on credible sightings that have happened. That news footage is from a sighting that happened in 2016, I believe. It was in September, and it happened in a northern area of British Columbia. Basically, it was a culmination of reports that news broadcast sort of happened. And those reports included people hearing strange howls at night. Wildlife biologist John Bindernagel, who's actually recently passed away, he traveled to the site in northern British Columbia to investigate. And he found the data that was coming out of this investigation to be very credible, because the recordings of the howls that were being emitted at night all over the island didn't seem to come from a known cataloged wildlife animal that we have here. So it wasn't a coyote, wasn't a wolf, it wasn't an owl, you know, things that people would use, or a raccoon or something, things that people would equate to making strange howls at night. And these types of deep, sort of chesty, reverberating howls have been known and cataloged by researchers in the Bigfoot and Sasquatch, you know, investigations over the years. So, interestingly enough, you can go online and you can search for known vocal, like noises or vocalizations that can come from animals across North America. And whenever these sort of sightings happen and there's vocalizations that are recorded, they aren't tied to something that's part of the wildlife catalog we know of in North America. So that was one part of that story that was aired on Canadian television. The other part of the story was that, you know, this island where the vocalizations and the sightings happened, it's very remote. It's in northern British Columbia. It has not been known that there are any real predators on the island. Not even deer can be found there because it's isolated from land. And basically people right around the same time that they were hearing these vocalizations, there were teenagers and adults that had seen an upright-looking hairy ape walking in certain areas of the island in the forest. So, you know, that gives me some pause and makes me think this is probably pretty credible.
Well, I have to agree with you. I really felt your film credits everything it shows me. It questions it, then credits it. Like, you disproved the disbelievers. I thought that was a great job of Neuropart on the film. At one point in the film, you do switch to a giant squid, though.
Okay, yeah. So the reason for that is to just parallel the thinking of an animal or a creature that we know exists, but we don't see too often. And it was a fable at one point, giant squids. You know, they were creatures that sailors had talked about all the way through the centuries, attacking their ships or taking their livestock, their fish, when they were doing fishing expeditions. And people have reported that sperm whales and other whales have had sort of battles with these creatures, right? The Kraken, for example, is a great fable of a sea monster that looks like a giant squid. And we know today, you know, we found trace evidence of these creatures in sperm whales, big tentacles found inside of dead bodies that are washed up on the shores. We also have heard of credible reports from Navy subs and all that stuff of massive creatures that have moved around on their sonar. And so with that news report from CNN, where they actually recorded on video a 26-foot giant squid taking some bait that some marine biologists had left at the bottom of the ocean near Chichi Island, which is it's part of the Japanese land formations out there. You know, it kind of was a parallel to the study of Sasquatch and Bigfoot, because we have found over the years hair samples, we've found footprints, we've found scat, we've found bones. Now, the bones would most of the time be fossilized bones, stuff that's found in the Himalayan region from Gigantopithecus, stuff from other sort of wild men that we've known to exist. Australopithecus is one of them. And then Neanderthal bones and such, they start to look very similar to what you would consider an ape man. And, you know, the hypothesis for the documentary is if people are seeing these things and reporting these things in high frequency, you know, around the world, really, not just in North America, but that's a hot spot. And we're also finding trace evidence of these encounters. So footprints, hair samples, scat, and some, you know, times we've found remnants of bones. Then why the heck aren't we taking it seriously as a creature that still exists? Because, you know, for the longest time, people thought giant squid didn't really exist. They thought it was just a machination of the mind of man, you know, to create a monster from such a massive body of water that we had to navigate. But we know they do exist. So that was the whole parallel there and why I introduced that idea.
Well, I think you do a great job. And I also want to touch on the I don't remember the man's name. I should have written it down. The guy that's a Bigfoot enthusiast that has the footprints and breaks them down for me.
Yeah. That's Jeff Meldrum.
Oh, my God. He's, the guy is amazing.
Yeah, he is. He's actually almost a hero to this whole subject. For the fact that, you know, it kind of started with there was researchers before Jeff Meldrum. Grover Kranz is definitely one to be noted. And even before Grover Kranz, there was lots of people that researched this and took this subject very seriously. But I think the thing about Grover Kranz and Jeff Meldrum that lend to their credibility is the fact that they're both anatomists and wildlife researchers. So with Jeff Meldrum, he's actually, you know, he heads up and teaches still at the Idaho State University as an anthropology PhD. And he's also done wildlife research through studying the locomotion of primates, you know, the way they move. Their anatomy and how it differs from us. And he's stated to me that when he came across the study of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, it really was the nexus or the crossroads and marriage of the two studies that he's become a professional in for his career. So it just made sense for him to look at that stuff credibly, given that there was so much research and trace evidence out there to be had. And you had stated earlier that he breaks down the footprints and he has so many casts on hand. And that also lends great credibility to the subject because, you know, people that have no idea about this subject whatsoever, if they ask you, do you believe in Bigfoot? They are assuming, even in that question most of the time, that there's one creature roaming around, you know, the outskirts of our society in the wilderness. But that's because Bigfoot is a singular name. It lends to discrediting the whole research of the subject. But the theory is that there are, you know, a vast population in scarce areas of the wilderness that we don't inhabit, that is far from our reach most of the time. And so there are multiple trace evidence encounters that have happened over the years, and there therefore have been thousands of casts made over the years in North America, let alone the world, because really the subject of wild men, which are kind of ape-like men or subhumans, some kind of creature that is human-like in nature but really is an ape-type being, that has been part of cultural history of multiple cultures around the world forever. You know, in Europe, there's a great history of wild men. And then in places like Russia, they have what's called the Dev or Deva, which translates to the devil, because people who have seen a ape-like, you know, sort of wild-looking man that's covered in fur from head to toe, that isn't wearing clothing and using tools like we would traditionally do, they've reported this thing that they call the devil, because it scares them and it's not us. In other parts of the world, you have a wild man called the Orange Pendek, which is, I believe that's Indonesia, where they've reported the sort of wild man version of their Bigfoot. And in Australia, they have their own wild man that they've reported that's not Aboriginal. The Aboriginal have a record of a hairy sort of bipedal ape. So really what I'm trying to get at is that these two researchers, Jeff Meldrum and Grover Kranz, they collected footprint records from all around the world and mostly in North America of Bigfoot and other wild men sightings. And because they're both trained in anatomy, they would study the footprints quite closely, and they would see things in the footprints that look like a fully anatomical working foot that's different from a human foot.
Okay. Throughout the film, you show me tons and tons of footage of sightings of Bigfoot, people talking about Bigfoot. I guess my question is, with the new iPhones and everybody has cameras and all this, how come we're not getting new footage of Bigfoot, do you think?
You know what? That's a great question. But to answer that, we are getting plenty of footage. Every year, people are having sightings and posting their sightings on YouTube. Now, are all those sightings credible? Probably not.
Well, that's what I was going to go to next. Yep. You're going down the way I'm going. Yep.
There's people that want to add fire to the sensationalism of this subject. And then there's people that don't want any credits or fame from their footage, and they submit it to research organizations that are, you know, completely run by volunteers like the BFRO, who take Bigfoot and Sasquatch sightings quite seriously. And they have a database of these sightings and history they've kept of all of these reports from across North America. Kind of like in the UFO realm, there's another agency called MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, who research and take UFO sightings seriously, and they keep a database of all this, right? So what I'm saying is some videos are put up online. Probably most of the sensational ones that you've seen end up on YouTube, and some of them have been debunked as, you know, some people messing around that are looking for some fame or fortune possibly. But other ones, other videos do get submitted to organizations directly, like the BFRO. And those researchers will break down the video, will take a look at the evidence and the testimony from the people that were involved, and then it's up for people to decide whether they think it's real or not.
Now, throughout the documentary, you have an older person that started the Bigfoot thing, and then you go to the new people. There are no women in your documentary, and you don't interview really any women. Why is that?
Well, there are women that are interested in this field of research. And in that documentary, Thomas Steinberg, he's interviewed, we show one of his more recent footcasts that he took from a sighting, right? And he talks about how he went
with a woman.
That with a woman named Christy, and how her dog almost destroyed the footprint, all of the footprints, by falling into them.
Yeah.
And trampling. So, yes, there are women. I didn't interview any women, and maybe I should. I don't intend to be sexist, but I do believe that the people that have been spending hours investigating this so far, to my knowledge, have mostly been men, but there are women. And I actually went to a conference in Washington State last year. I believe it was in October. It's called the Sasquatch Summit. And there is a group of women that presented on a recent expedition that they did. And on the expedition, they took with them a heat-sensitive camera, and they recorded what looks like a Sasquatch in the middle of the night eating fish in the forest, which was very, very interesting. And I'd love to sort of interview them about that footage, actually. I'm working on a follow-up documentary to that one that you watched recently. And they said they were interested in actually sharing that video and talking with me about how they captured that video. But it wasn't just one person that shot that video. It was a number of folks. They were on basically a Sasquatch hunt, so to speak, but, you know, with no intention of hunting, like shooting or anything like that, just with the intention of finding. So yeah, there are ladies, there are women interested in this field. And to go a little bit further to your question, not that you asked it, but I can tell by the question, the nature of the question, that you wonder if this subject is just, you know, predominantly researched by maybe white males.
Wow, you're really going deep, but sure, I'll give it to you.
Okay, well, the reason why I say that is because I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast quite recently. He did one, and a skeptic was on there talking about, I don't know, something that was completely unrelated to the Sasquatch and Bigfoot subject. But Joe Rogan brought it up, and he said, you know, he didn't believe in it. And he said, you know, most of this subject is studied by white men. Ask any black man if they've ever researched this subject, and they would laugh at you, and you know, so on and so forth. So I went to this this conference in Washington recently, and the host of the conference was a Englishman, like a man from England who was African American, or sorry, not African. He was African English, let's say. So I think Joe Rogan is dead wrong, and it just shows that he really hasn't done any research on the subject. He's probably just taken hearsay for its word, and you know, I think he should stick to studying UFC, you know, mixed martial arts over this type of shit.
Fair enough. Have you ever gone on a Bigfoot hunt?
Have I ever seen?
Have you gone looking for one? Yes. I think that's a fair question.
I live in British Columbia, and I've been on many hikes and sort of expeditions, so to speak, around the outskirts of Vancouver and Victoria, which is Vancouver Island. I've never gone looking for Sasquatch or Bigfoot, so to speak. But whenever I go hiking, I kind of, I don't know, keep my wits about me. And when I look around the landscape in the mountains or in the forest, I look for indicators of wildlife being around, you know, for prints and hair that may be stuck to bark and that type of thing. So I am curious to see if I would ever find this stuff myself. But I really do leave that in the hands of the experts, the people who are investigating this stuff on a yearly basis, you know, that really put their 10,000 hours in, so to speak.
When doing your research, was there one thing that you found like, wow, I didn't know that? That's fascinating. Like for me, it was the feet.
Yeah, definitely. I had no idea when I first, as I said earlier in the interview, that I wasn't really into this subject when I first came across it. I thought for sure it was just another attention-seeking sort of media frenzy that people had taken up just to, I don't know, find something different in the world. But when I started researching it, I was invited by a friend to a basically a festival that happens north of Vancouver in British Columbia in an area called Harrison Hot Springs. And the native Canadian tribes there have believed and seen this creature for hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's part of their oral history. And when I went up there, Bill Miller is who I interviewed. He was the first person I interviewed for this documentary. And you have seen the footage in the documentary. He had casts, he had photos, he had every single question that I had about this subject and about this creature, he had an answer for that was credible. And it blew me away, really. It caught me off guard. And then when I followed up to find out more information about the foot casts, about the prints, with Jeff Meldrum, who's a, you know, trained anatomist and anthropologist, I was completely caught off guard by the fact that the foot of this creature is supposedly similar to a human foot, but different, because it has what would be described as a prehension to the foot. You know, a foot that can sort of grasp more like a hand than a traditional human foot can. And this is described, the anatomy that I'm describing is called a mid-tarsal break. It allows for more midfoot flexibility And it also allows for a creature that's quite heavy, you know, some purport it to be at least maybe 800 pounds. And that's not, you know, there's nothing very surprising about that in wildlife. You've got elk and other caribou and stuff like that that can get them way more than 800 pounds. But this creature would need that extra flexibility if it were to be walking through clinal rainforests that have quite a variation of elevation, and if they were to move quickly, it would help for them to have this type of anatomy and to grip while they're walking uphill or climbing.
Now, I got a quick question about your crew. Is it just you and the lighting guy, or who's on your crew while you film?
Yeah, so for the majority of my films, the crew is me. I have, over the years, filmed with multiple different types of DSLRs, Canon, Nikon, and now I use a Fujifilm 4K system. But sometimes, for example, I made a documentary called Being Taken. And that documentary, we go over the hypothesis that people have discussed being abducted by possible aliens in the past. And we cover some of the more credible, more controversial cases and such. For that one, I actually was on site recording with my friend Lee Lustig, who lives in LA. And for this one, I did have help from a friend at the time named Alicia. But usually I'm on my own. When I recorded the scenes that I interviewed Jeff Meldrum in his lab out in Idaho State, I flew down there with a lavalier mic, Sennheiser lavalier mic, a Nikon D5300, and I used basically LED lighting kit to create some separation.
Do you find it difficult shooting just by yourself with no help?
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes I wish I had a crew, but you know, the perks of working alone is that you're your own boss. It's hard to organize people sometimes, and it's also a great financial investment up front to employ somebody to do everything for you, right? So I've learned, you know, a guerrilla filmmaking style, and it's worked for me over the years. I'm getting better and better at it. And I think, you know, this year and possibly the years to come, I'm actually going to be switching over to, you know, employing more creatives to help me in my effort to tell these stories that I want to get out there.
How long does it take you to get your documentary, I guess, finished from beginning, middle, and ready to go for me to watch it?
It varies. That's a good question. I mean, I'd like to say if everything goes well, I can probably finish a documentary in 6 months.
Okay, I was thinking of a year at least.
Yeah, I've had documentaries that have taken a year plus.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, you're a one-man crew. You got to edit. You got to shoot. You got to do everything.
That's right. And even with editing, sometimes I get help, and you know, I credit those that have helped me. I can't do the score myself because I'm not that musically inclined, but I have an ear for music that I want to hear. So really, when it gets to a certain point in post-production, that's when I pull together animators. For example, in this film, there was some simple animation that you might have noticed. I employed Ashley Lane for that. And yeah, you know, music was done by Alessandro Saini. He actually recently came off of scoring or assisting with the main musician that scored what's that film? The Avenger lady. She's like
Black Widow?
No.
Captain Marvel?
Captain Marvel. Yeah, he helped score Captain Marvel. So if you look up Alessandro Saini, you know, this was like his first feature film that he had scored, and I think he did an amazing job.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, I try to work with as many creatives as I can, given the budget I have or the time I have. And with this documentary, it actually probably took over a year.
I can just give.
Yeah, given the fact that I didn't even then, because it was an earlier film that I've made, I didn't have all of those creatives ready to go. And I had toured this film in the film festival circuit for probably about 6 months. And then once I got a bunch of feedback from that tour and I had a few more ideas, I actually went out and I shot some more stuff and then put it together for a final version that I, you know, you have seen now.
Okay. Since I think we've covered everything. I don't think we've missed anything. So you ready for some fun questions?
I'm ready.
Your favorite film?
My favorite film. Can I pick a genre, maybe?
Of course, anything you want to do. Go nuts.
Okay. Favorite horror films, probably John Carpenter's The Thing. Favorite musical is Oh Lucky Man. Favorite comedy is probably Dumb and Dumber. Favorite drama, maybe Good Will Hunting.
Great film.
Yeah, I mean, what else am I missing?
It's all good. One film that made you want to be a director?
Film that made me want to be a director.
Hard one for you?
Yeah. I think have you ever seen a movie called Monster Squad?
Yes, 80s.
Yeah. I think when I saw that film, I was a little boy, and it became a classic for my older brother and I to watch all the time. We had it on VHS.
Of course.
And, you know, we memorized the words, and it was a funny but frightening film. Especially for the fact that it had violence, sexual, suggestive behavior, and all that stuff. Really wasn't made for my age when I watched it, but I watched it religiously at the time. I think that made me want to become a filmmaker because I saw children that were around my age acting in the film, and I figured I could do that.
Yeah.
You know?
That's great. The last film you saw in the theater?
I just saw Underwater.
And I'm going to have to ask you, did you like it?
Yeah, I thought it was a very cool film when it came to special effects, and some of the pacing was really good. It kept you on the edge of your seat. You weren't really bored at any point in the film. But I would say that it's not the most novel idea when it comes to a horror film. It was essentially, I could sum up the film as Cloverfield underwater.
I 100% agree.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I saw your film on YouTube. Are there other places you can find your film?
No, I think I sent the link that I sent you was for Tubi TV.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was on Tubi. See, that's why we're here.
So it's available on Tubi TV. You don't have to subscribe or, you know, pay for that. It's completely free service that people can check it out on. And then it's also available on Amazon Prime. If you have a membership with that, it's free. And Google Play, YouTube Red, Apple, to name a few more. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for your time and have a great night.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Love to be on the show again sometime. Take care, Simon.
You will be. Bye-bye.